Good morning, everyone. This is Pastor Ian here with PGC. Thank you for joining us for our English worship service. Today, I want to talk to you guys about my great aunt, Marion. Now, when I was growing up, my family would go to Montreal, usually during the Christmas break, to see my great aunt, Marion, and my great aunt, Ruth. They were my grandfather's sisters, and they were a part of our family for a very long period of time. They actually lived to be 93 and 100 years old, respectively. And I can remember celebrating my great aunt Marion's 100th year birthday. And I can remember the conversations that we had and how difficult it was because at that time her memory had started to go. And I can remember treating it as if it was just any other party. I know it was 100 years and it was a big deal and it was a celebration, but with Marion, everything was humble. She didn't really make a big deal about herself. And she'd always been living in Montreal. She was just a part of our lives, traveling to Montreal to see her. I can remember I celebrated my 18th birthday in Montreal with her, and it was the first time she ever made me a birthday cake. It was the first time I ever got a chocolate cake for my birthday. That was in October of that year, and by the end of the year, she would die. And I know at that time, I didn't realize that this 100 years was going to be the last year of her life. It just seemed like she was always going to keep going. She was always going to keep living because she had been living for my entire life. But she didn't. There was a point in time where I thought she was never going to die. And then she did. You see, part of human nature is denying something that we all kind of know to be true. The fact that we are all going to die one day. And we put it off and think, not today, probably not tomorrow, maybe not this week, probably not this year though, definitely not this year. And what we do is we actually trick ourselves into believing that we are somehow in control of the number of days we have left to live. My great aunt Marion, she didn't have that control. I don't have that control. None of us have that control of deciding the day upon which we die. What we see here is that human nature desires to be in control, that wants, that has that possessive need to control our lives, to keep ourselves safe, to extend our lifespan. But really, we actually have none of this control. We see here in the book of Daniel chapter 5, which is admittedly a long chapter, we see a king desperate for that type of control, willing to do almost anything to be able to regain control over his life, and yet he finds out the hard way that it is God who has weighed him, measured him, and found him wanting. What we see here is that God is the one who is in control of our days. He is the one who decides our fate. And that if we trust in him, then it doesn't matter how many or how few days we have, because then we will have the exact number that we were supposed to have. That really what matters is what we choose to do today, now, not something that we do far off in the future. So if you turn with me to Daniel chapter 5, we're going to be reading about King Belshazzar. We're not going to be reading the entire chapter with me right now, but as we go through the sermon, I'll be referring to different verses. So if you can just pull up the Bible passage right now, Daniel chapter 5, and we'll go along through it. So if you remember, in previous chapters, we were talking about this king called King Nebuchadnezzar. That was the king who was the original villain of Daniel's story. He's the guy who destroys the temple. He's the guy who breaks down Jerusalem. He's the guy who throws all the Jews into exile. He's that guy. But he is no longer the king. He has since died. And now we have this new king, Belshazzar, who is actually the successor to King Nebuchadnezzar. And King Belshazzar, he's a guy who likes to party. I can understand that. He has a great feast in verse 1. Thousands of his nobles are all drinking wine. And then he makes a bit of a mistake. Perhaps, parents, this is a good learning opportunity for us to teach our kids about not drinking too much. Because King Belshazzar, man, that name is just going to keep tripping me up today. King Belshazzar does something very, very foolish. In verse 2, it says, under the influence of the wine, Belshazzar gave orders to bring in the gold and silver vessels that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem so that the king and his nobles, wives and concubines could drink from them. So Nebuchadnezzar's had a little bit too much to drink. He's a little tipsy. And so he says, you know what? I don't want to drink from these things. I want to drink from the cups that we stole from Jerusalem because those are the ones that I really, really want. Those are the special ones. Those are the temple ones. And so he does it. And at the moment that they begin to drink the wine and praise their gods made of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and began writing on the plaster of the king's palace wall next to the lampstand. And as the king watched the hand that was writing, his face turned pale and his thoughts so terrified him that he soiled himself and his knees knocked together. So he's made a fatal mistake. His fatal mistake was, number one, using the cups that were reserved for God's priests in his temple. But number two, it's at that time praising his gods made of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. What Belshazzar has done is he has desecrated these items, literally meaning he has taken something that is sacred, something that is special, something that is holy, and he has used them in an unholy way. That's basically what it means to desecrate something. It means to take something sacred and make it not sacred anymore. And so this finger appears and starts writing on his wall in a secret language that nobody can understand. And the king is obviously terrified. Well, why is he terrified? He's so terrified his knees are knocking together. He pees himself. His face turns pale and he shouts for all of his mediums in verse 7. He's telling everybody to come in to explain to him what's going to happen because he is afraid. Deep down in his heart, he is afraid because this is a supernatural event. Because if we are able to understand the natural world and the different things that happen in it, it gives us a level of control because there are rules to how the universe works. We know, for example, that if I drop this Bible, that it's going to fall to the ground, and that's normal. But imagine for a second what would happen if I dropped this Bible and it began to rise up to the ceiling. Many of us would immediately assume that it was some type of special video edit that I did. Or really, it actually did fall to the ground, but I just made it look like it floated to the ceiling. Because we couldn't live in a world where things like that could actually happen. Something that's outside of our control, where gravity all of a sudden begins to act wonky ways. How weird is it if we have an experience that isn't explainable through science or how we observe the natural world around us? Well, Belshazzar has this experience. He sees this random hand drawing on the wall, and I've never seen anything like that, and chances are you've never seen anything like that. Some random hand writing on your wall? Now, first of all, we know that Belshazzar is not afraid of his parents walking in being like, you wrote on my wall, so help me. That's not the reason why. It's number one, because it's a hand that appears out of nowhere, and it writes in a language that nobody can understand. One of my favorite TV shows growing up was Supernatural, and the series was entirely devoted to the basic idea that the supernatural world, those things and myths and legends, that they are fundamentally scary, and that they actually pose a significant threat to the world and to the humans who are living in it. Almost every single episode of Supernatural starts the exact same way. It starts off with a regular person going about their business, and then all of a sudden there's a sound, there's a noise, something happens, and whoever it is that starts at the beginning of any episode of Supernatural dies. Not every single time, but almost every single time, they die. And it's always a mystery about what is doing it, and how do you stop it, and nobody knows. But as a young person, that was kind of scary, because I'm like, oh man, that's kind of terrifying. A spirit that can just drag you from when you're going swimming in the lake and just pull you down? I can't fight it, I can't stop it? It's a little bit terrifying. And Belshazzar has this experience. So he gets so desperate. He yells at everyone to save him. He's like, listen, I need you to save me. I need you to tell me what I need to do to understand what's going on. He says, whoever can read this inscription in verse 7 and gives me its interpretation will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around his neck, and have the third highest position in the kingdom. He tries to buy his way out of it. He's like, listen, I really, really need to know what's going on here, so I'm going to offer a reward to whoever can tell me the answer. But nobody can do it. Verse 8, no one could read the inscription or make its interpretation known to him. And so, in verse 9, King Belshazzar becomes even more terrified, his face turned pale, and his nobles were bewildered. What's more terrifying than the supernatural finger drawing words on a wall that you can't understand? When even your wise people, the people who are dedicated to knowing the supernatural, don't have a clue what's going on. Belshazzar is afraid. But at that moment, somebody remembers Daniel. Remember Daniel, the guy who's writing this story? The queen comes to the banquet and says, "May the king live forever. Don't let your thoughts terrify you or your face be pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has a spirit of the holy gods in him. The days of your predecessor, he was found to have insight, intelligence, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods. Your predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, mediums, Chaldeans, diviners. Your own predecessor, the king, did this because Daniel, the one the king named Belteshazzar, not Belshazzar, but Belteshazzar, man, Babylonian names, am I right? Was found to have an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and intelligence, and the ability to interpret dreams, explaining riddles, and solve problems. Summon Daniel, he will give the interpretation." How good it is that King Belshazzar had a wise wife, a wise queen, because she realizes that this is beyond the mediums. This is beyond the people that Belshazzar has surrounded himself with. She recognizes that this is a job that only Daniel can solve. Remember, Daniel had a reputation under King Nebuchadnezzar, and we don't know at this point if he still managed to keep his position. Because usually what happens is when an old king dies and a new king comes into office, they'd want to put their own people in positions of power and authority because they feel comfortable with them, because they know them. And chances are Daniel was not known by this particular king. So the queen says to him, "Go get Daniel." And so Belshazzar summons Daniel, and he tries the exact same thing. He says, "Listen, I know that you have the spirit of the holy gods. I've heard about you that you can solve interpretations and problems. If you can read this inscription and give me its interpretation, you'll be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around your neck, and have the third highest position in the kingdom." He tries to bribe him, to give him a gift, saying, "Please, you have the information that I need. I will reward you if you can do it." And Daniel says no. In verse 17, he says, "No, thank you. You keep your gifts. I don't need them." To those who are following after God, there is a time and a place for financial support. There's a time and a place where we need to be supported so that way we can do God's work. But there is also a time for putting aside greed and saying we don't actually need a reward. We don't need to be financially compensated for helping people. Sometimes helping people is just our way of serving God, and we actually don't need any reward. There is no time or a place for greed for those who are following after God. And Daniel shows us this. He chooses to give Belshazzar the answer basically for free. He says, "All right, I'll do it." He says, "I will read the inscription for the king and make the interpretation known to him." But then he does something different. Before he reads it, he tells Belshazzar a story. He reminds him of his predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar. You see, because one of the benefits of youth is that we have the sense of optimism and confidence, where we think that we know better than the generation that came before us. We have this feeling that we know better. And when people who are older than us try and tell us the way that things should be or how to do things, we kind of brush them off and be like, okay, old man, I understand. I can remember one time I was talking with my dad about a computer problem that he had, and he explained to me how I thought that I knew so much about computers, but he back in the day actually had to program his own computer. And I kind of waved him off being like, "Well, that's no longer relevant, because so what? You used to do that when you were younger, but now we don't use any of that same technology. It's a totally different ballgame." There's a temptation when parents or figures in authority try and tell us what to do or tell us how things should be done, to kind of look within ourselves and be like, "That's fine, you did that your way when it was your time, but now it is my time. I don't need to listen to you anymore." But there's a benefit to learning from the mistakes of others. There's a benefit to listening to our elders, to listening to our parents, to listening to the people who are in positions of authority, to learn from them. That doesn't mean that just because you are elder or just because you're a parent or just because you are in a position of authority, you know better. It doesn't mean that you're always right. But it does mean that there are things that we can learn from people who have made mistakes before us. And we, as people who are in positions of authority, parents, we must be willing to teach our children through our mistakes, through the mistakes that we have made possibly when we were even at the same age as our own children. Because when we do that, it makes us relatable. It humbles us. And it doesn't shame the person who is learning from us. Because the temptation is when we try and teach about how things used to be when we were growing up, it's not very relatable. Because oftentimes, it actually isn't relatable. In my dad's example, he's trying to tell me about how he used to program his own computer, and I'm like, cool, but you're asking me how I can copy one document from one computer and export it into a different type of file onto a different computer. Those two things have nothing to do with one another. It doesn't matter. Also, when we are teaching people, it is easy for us to come across as proud or know-it-alls because we're being like, oh, wow, you don't even know how to do that? Oh, okay, well, I guess I can show you. But notice the way that I said that. It makes you feel uncomfortable because you're like, well, great, now I'd rather not ask you for help ever. And also because it doesn't shame people. When we show how we have made mistakes, it tells people that it's okay to make mistakes, that you're not the first person to have ever made a mistake in your life, that everyone before you has made a mistake. Maybe not the same mistake, maybe not the same size mistake, but we've all made mistakes. But when we learn from the mistakes of others, we actually help ourselves to not make the same mistake that our parents or that the people that we are learning from have made in the past. And that's what Daniel does. He retells the story of Nebuchadnezzar. He retells Belshazzar a story that he should already know about how Nebuchadnezzar was this great and powerful king, and yet God turned his mind into that of a cow, and then he starts wandering around in the fields, and only then is he returned when God chooses it, when he is acknowledged as the Most High God, ruler over human kingdoms. In verse 22, he says, "But you, his successor Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this." He says, listen, bro, you should have been studying your history, because Nebuchadnezzar already made this mistake. This is a bad rerun. This is Home Alone 4. We've already learned the mistakes. You should have stopped. Arguably 2. It's important for us to remember our history. Now, maybe I'm saying that because I love history and you can't stand history. And I'm like, okay, cool. I hear you. But when we actually take the time to learn the interesting bits of history, I'm not talking about the genealogies. I'm not talking about who married who and what, you know, what their descendants were all named and all the children. I'm not talking about that stuff. I'm talking about the big ideas of history. When we learn those things, we're in a better position to not make the same mistake a second time. Now, some of you may know, I did run for city council. It was my first time running for political office. I went to school for political science. I've worked on campaigns basically all my life, but I'd never run as the candidate before. And I made mistakes. I did things that, looking back, it would have been better if I didn't do it that particular way. I learned that when you're talking with people, it's better to just be direct, short, sweet, get to the point. Don't talk about the issues in the sense of don't talk around them. Tell people exactly what you believe and what you're going to do for them. I also learned that what's more important than your ideas is if you can actually get those ideas to people. If you don't take your ideas to people in a great enough number, it doesn't matter how good your ideas are because nobody's going to hear about them. But I didn't know those things firsthand. I knew about them in the back of my head, but I never understood how valuable they were until I ran for public office. So if you wanted to run for public office and you went to me and said, Pastor Ian, what are some of the things that you would recommend that I do as a first-time candidate? One of the first things that I would say is be direct. Don't talk around the issue. Say, oh, well, you know, homelessness is a really big issue, or, you know, housing affordability is a really big issue. No, no, no. Get to the issue. Say what you're going to do. Because oftentimes you don't have more than 10 to 20 seconds to connect with people. The elevator pitch, that's really what you got to do. And the moment that you sound confident and you're direct and to the point, people respect that. People don't like it when a candidate, when a politician sounds like a politician, where they're like, well, you know, you're just talking about this and wanting to do about that. No, 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 no. It doesn't matter. What matters is if you can show people with your words that you are there for them. Daniel tries to teach that to Belshazzar, to show him that Nebuchadnezzar made the mistake once, you are making the mistake twice, but you have no excuse because you had Nebuchadnezzar to learn from, but you chose not to. But all that being the same, he points out to him, he says, "You praise the gods made of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood,
and stone, which do not see or hear or understand, but you have not glorified the God who holds your life breath in his hand and who controls the whole course of your life. That is the indictment against Belshazzar. This is not something that is unique to him. His father, or his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar, did very similar things. But Belshazzar can't say, well, you know what? You clearly forgave Nebuchadnezzar for what he did. Forgive me. So what Daniel does is he says, okay, listen, I'm going to tell you what you've done wrong, and now I'm going to actually do what I said I was going to do, or I'm actually going to tell you the interpretation. And he says in verse 25, this is the writing that was inscribed. It says, many, many, tickle, parson. And that roughly interprets to, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel means you have been found weighed on the balance and found deficient. And in 28, Perez means that your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So basically, what Daniel is saying is God is in control of his life. He is in control of Belshazzar's life and death. How does he put it? In verse 23, he says, you have not glorified the God who holds your life breath in his hand and who controls the whole course of your life. God is the one who decides Belshazzar's fate. He has weighed him. He has numbered. He has counted the days of the kingdom, and he has decided that the Babylonian kingdom, their empire, has seen its last day. He has weighed Belshazzar. He has judged him based off of his actions and what he has chosen to do with the time that he had been given, and found him deficient because of what we have already seen. He has not praised the God of the heavens. He has praised gods made of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or understand. That's what Belshazzar chose to do with his life. He didn't learn from the mistakes of his predecessor. He always thought, well, I guess then I'd have more time. But he doesn't. Now, as it turns out, Belshazzar actually does reward Daniel. He does give him the purple cloak. He actually does give him a gold chain. He does make him the third ruler in the kingdom. But what do you think happens to him? Do you think that he has the exact same story as Nebuchadnezzar? Where Nebuchadnezzar has that period of time where he's driven wild in his brain and he thinks he's an animal and he goes out into the wilderness. But then eventually he's allowed to come back once he recognizes God is king. Verse 30, it says, that very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. The king thought he had more time. He thought that that day was not his last day. He always figured he could make amends. He figured that if he was worshiping this god in the same way as all the other gods, then he would be able to make an offering or sacrifice, something to appease that particular god. But notice, even in verse 29, it doesn't say that Belshazzar did anything different for God. It says that he gave an order to make Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom, gave him a purple cloak, he gives him a gold chain. But notice that he doesn't actually say anything to God. He doesn't say that he's sorry. He doesn't say that he should be worshiping him. He doesn't do the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar did, where he recognizes that God is the Most High King, the God above all, the Lord of the heavens. He didn't say anything. He thought he had more time. He thought he had more time. Friends, we are in a similar position as King Belshazzar. We don't know how many days we have left. We don't even know what tomorrow will bring us. And it's tempting for us to plan for a future that we might never see. Oftentimes, we're taught when we're young to plan for our retirement, to invest in our retirement. And I can remember when I was just finished seminary, I had a student loan that I had to pay off. And someone told me, listen, you need to start saving for your retirement. And I can remember thinking to myself, how can I save for my retirement when I can't even pay my bills now because I have to pay off the student loan that's just growing and growing and growing. But that's kind of ingrained in us, this idea of saving money for tomorrow. That there are some things that we should do today, but we choose to do them later because we assume that we have the next day when we don't. It's God who holds the whole course of our lives in his hand. He is the one who chooses the number of days that we have. All that we have is right now. It's all we've got. One of the things that I learned from my parents, and one of the things that I learned from my dad growing up, was the importance of saying I love you and goodbye to my parents every time when I left home. It's something that my dad would do even when I was in university. He would still make it his business to wake me up and say, I love you, son. Have a good day. Because in his mind, he didn't want to go to work and to have not said that he loved me if anything should happen. If today was his last day, he wanted it to be have been a day where he said, I love you, son. And I love that. That meant something to me. Because if you knew that today was your last day, how would you live your life differently? Now, it's not entirely possible for us to live this way because there are some things that make sense for us to do. There are pragmatic reasons for us to save money. There are pragmatic reasons for us to look to the future and say, well, you know, what university do you want to go to? What high school do you want to go to? What elective courses are you going to take? Who do you want to marry? In fact, should you be saving for retirement? How should you be saving for retirement? Those are important questions for us to ask. But to always keep in the back of our minds this idea that there is a God who holds your life breath in his hands and who controls the whole course of your life. That means that even though you make plans, it's up to God to decide whether or not they come to fruition or not. You can plan as much as you want to get into whatever university you want, and if God has decided for you to go somewhere else, guess what's going to happen? I thought I was going to go to Queen's University. I had excellent marks. I had good extracurriculars. I thought, you know what? I am going to get in here for sure. And it was the one university I didn't get into. God didn't want me to go there. He wanted me to go on a different path. All we have is the now. That's all we have. So let's use it wisely. Instead of Belshazzar, who's having this nasty feast where he gets drunk and he decides to do something terrible by desecrating God's holy cups that were used in his temple, instead, what should he have done? He should have done what Nebuchadnezzar did just in a chapter earlier, where he should have acknowledged and glorified the King of the heavens. And if today is your last day, that's what we need to do, to glorify the King of the heavens, to glorify the God above all others. Our days are numbered. They have been counted. And we are in the process of being weighed. The question is, are we going to be found deficient? Are we going to be found wanting? Or are we going to be found in Christ? Because we can look at the story and say, well, does that mean that I have to do more good than bad? If God's going to weigh the course of my life, is he going to say, did you do more good things than bad things? That means I need to do more good things. Friends, that's not what this means. If all we're trying to do is accumulate more good deeds than bad, then we are going to be forever found in deficit. But with Christ, we will always be found in excess, in surplus. We will not be found in deficit because our righteousness, our right standing before God, will not be because of how many good things we did as opposed to how many bad things we did. It will be because of what Christ has already done for us. Christ intervenes for us. Jesus intervenes for us. He is the one who gives us an example to follow. In the same way that King Belshazzar had Nebuchadnezzar to follow, we have Jesus Christ. And what did he do every day of his life? Honored God. Served God. Even when Jesus decides to put off something that he wants to do, he doesn't do it for very long. He knows that he has to do it quickly. Even when his friend Lazarus dies and all of his friends are, or is, when they say that Lazarus is sick and all of his friends are like, Jesus, we gotta hurry. Jesus takes his sweet time to get there. He takes his sweet time to get there because he knows the Father's will is that Lazarus should die so that he can be raised back to life. But Jesus doesn't delay in doing good for people. And the same is true for us. We are surrounded by people who love us or people who are in need of being loved by us. people who are in need of a loving Savior, someone who can intervene in their life to make a difference for them. And if you know Jesus Christ, then our obligation every day with every interaction we have is to show the love of Christ, to make a connection with people so that God may be glorified, to not put off what should be done today to tomorrow because tomorrow may never arrive for us, to treat every single moment as if it is a precious gift from God, and to remember that our culture tells us that you have to be in control of your own safety and the course of your life, but ultimately that it is God who has the numbers of our days in His hands, that it is His choice when we live or when we die, and to trust Him that if He has given us this moment, this time, that it is for a purpose, that is for it is something to be done for His glory and for His good. Notice then verse 30, Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans was killed. But who survives? Daniel. Daniel is allowed to live. The king dies, but Daniel survives. Because God was not done with Daniel. And God is not done with us either. For as long as we breathe on this earth, He has a plan and a purpose for us. However, it is up to us to walk in obedience with Him. So take this day, use it for God's glory and honor Him. Love one another as He has loved us. That is what we can learn from today. To not be like Belshazzar, too foolish and too proud, too fearful, but instead to walk in faith and a trust that if Christ is for us, then who can stand against us? Amen.